First Things podcast, on this episode, I'll talk with senior editor Mark Bauerlein about President Trump's inauguration and his first week in office. Then I'll be joined by an unearthly guest or two as I discuss The Exorcist, that great work of homiletic horror by the very Catholic William Peter Blatty, who departed this life a couple of weeks ago. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for listening. Donald Trump has completed his first week in office as the 45th President of the United States. He took office on Friday, January 20th, delivering an inaugural speech that the press called dark and bleak. The following day, organized marches took place across the country, protesting Trump's treatment of women and most other sorts of creatures. And then he started issuing executive orders and building walls and announcing that he'll soon announce his nominee to replace Scalia. I'm joined by Mark Bauerlein, who I'm sure has a few thoughts. So let's begin with that dark and bleak inaugural speech. The darkest, bleakest passage is perhaps the following, in which Trump describes the America of the forgotten man. Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation, an education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge, and the crime and gangs and drugs that have stolen too many lives. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now. Mark, your thoughts?
You know, what you just recounted brings up something that I did not see commented upon, and that is the remark about the public schools. Flush with cash. Students graduating from them with no knowledge. The facts certainly back Donald Trump up on that one, which could be why the press avoided that. Of course, public school funding has been going up for a long, long time. No Child Left Behind was a huge infusion of cash into the public education system from the federal government. And the results are not even disappointing. They're abysmal. SAT scores, reading scores, are at their lowest point in 40 years. When they do civics scores, only one-third of the students score proficient in civics. And when we hear people complain about the election, about American politics, about the low state of our political reality, including the low information voter, we should look at what is happening with U.S. history and civics education in the schools and how little students understand, young people understand, the nature of American politics, which is one reason why they were so darn upset at the election of Donald Trump. For a lot of the millennials, the political reality they have only known is Barack Obama in the White House. If you're 21, you were 13 when George W. Bush left office, and you don't remember that. The political wheel always turns. The momentum of history that the Democratic Party operated under for the last 8 years, the emerging Democratic majority, they thought that history with a capital H was theirs. And this is a trauma that they still haven't come to terms, many of them still haven't come to terms with.
One phrase from Trump's speech that I think made everyone's ears perk up was this American carnage. It's kind of a shocking phrase. And it's been controversial, even and especially among mainstream conservatives. So the editors of the Wall Street Journal wrote, "Subtlety is not the Trump style, and America has problems. But carnage is a word better suited for Aleppo under Russian bombing." George Will wrote that American carnage is a phrase the likes of which has never hitherto been spoken at an inauguration. So, Mark, what do you think about that phrase, American carnage, and just that moment of disrupting sort of civic decorum in an interesting rhetorical way?
First of all, I would say I don't know how widespread the misery is, that, I mean, in terms of just statistical patterns. But I certainly driven a lot across this country, several times across the country in the last 10 years. And I'm amazed at how dead small towns are. When you get off the freeway, I drive through small towns, from driving through Georgia down to Florida. And I wonder, what has happened to these villages? You go out and you've got the Walmart out there near the highway exit. But it seems that these are ghost towns, virtual ghost towns. I see them all over the place, across the country, when I drive. And the hollowing out of these neighborhoods certainly fits to me with carnage. Now, that term we usually reserve for battlefield, but Trump is obviously talking about economic decay and the miserable lives that people lead within them. And that led him to turn to the drug rates, the alcoholism, and the crime that we see popping up in so many areas. Now, if you live on the West Side in Los Angeles, anywhere on the West Coast, you know, from the waves to 2 miles inland, this doesn't affect you. The major urban growth areas, they all have their wonderful places to live, and that's where most of the media people do live. And so this carnage, they never see it. It never touches them. It never touches their children. They've never been inside a school in a rough area and seen what life is like there. They don't know people who lived in Rochester after, you know, Kodak collapsed. They just don't encounter that. So I would say that Trump's rhetoric, of course, it's exaggerated, but I think we're past the point where we trust George Will to give us an accurate measure of the full swath of the American people. And the parochialism that goes with that, I would say that we're seeing that becoming ever more visible with the advent of Donald Trump. And one reason why no one can seem to stop talking about him is that he's having some odd group psychology, social anthropology effect. He's like a figure, you know, the fool in a medieval play, the court figure who somehow his presence makes all these other people expose themselves. They are more open about things that they usually filter. I mean, Trump's bluntness, his exaggerations, his provocations are giving us outbursts by intelligent people, by people in media, in celebrity, who are intelligent people. But somehow the irrational components that all of us have inside of us are activated simply by his presence. That inauguration speech, he sat there and implicitly denounced everyone sitting behind him on both sides of the aisle. No conciliation, no softening, and the darkness that people read, I didn't feel that. I actually laughed several. I was sitting on the couch with Rusty. We were watching it together, laughing and shaking our heads, saying, well, it's going to be a wild ride. The accelerator is not, he's not hitting the brakes on things. But there were elements of it where I heard Walt Whitman talking. If you look at the opening pages of the 1855 preface to Leaves of Grass, he talks about elections and their power, the power of the elections. And he says that the genius of America is not in its delegates and representatives and executives. He uses those words. He says it's in the common people. It is in the common man. And he says the president, the people don't take their hat off to him. The president takes his hat off to them. Trump said exactly the same thing. So the populism, I found less Huey Long and more Walt Whitman.
It did create a sort of awkwardness, though, didn't it? You know, so he was demagoguing pretty hard, the people who are around him on the platform and who are the VIPs at his party. So it's just socially, it was a little, I got nervous.
We all felt uncomfortable by this. And Donald Trump leaves you on edge. The question you have to say is, have the protocols, the etiquette of political life, the demeanor that goes with being a senator, the gravitas that is supposed to go with the chief executive, have those things become political instruments? I would say they have, and that they have largely worked against the conservative side. The president used to be constrained because of tradition and protocol. Conservatives respect that, and that's part of their position. They respect norms and the orderly process of doing things in the shadow of the past. Progressives break with the past and change the rules accordingly. And there comes a point where conservatives have to say that we're losing the things that we care about so much that we are willing to support someone who is going to bring a hammer.
The afternoon of Saturday, the 21st, saw the Women's March on Washington and simultaneous similar protests in other towns and cities. I've seen it estimated, I have no idea how accurate this is, but estimated that the marches drew 3 million attendees, which would be roughly 10 times as many as the Tea Party rallies did during their heyday. Of course, hecklers may observe that 3 million was also Hillary Clinton's margin in the national popular vote, much good it did her. Anyway, I think that about half these folks were on the 6 train I took from Union Square to Grand Central that afternoon. I was seeing all these signs with profane slogans and thinking, I just want to go to Brooks Brothers on Madison Avenue. Get out of my way, hippies.
I find that there is an element of delusion. When I was walking with my son down 2nd Avenue on Saturday afternoon, I was taking him to his cello class, a group of about 200 people marched by, and they were singing, "We Shall Overcome, We Shall Overcome." And I was looking around, where are the dogs? Where are the fire hoses? Where are the cops with nightsticks ready to knock some heads? It's got to be 1961 here. It's got to be 1959 down in Alabama. And I think overcome what? I mean, this is such a misconstrual of reality at this point. Now, in another sense, they're right. They are right in that what Donald Trump represents is a nuclear bomb on all of the socio-cultural formations of liberalism, the political correctness, and the identity politics. And the protests, again, the moral indignation is a way to try to retain the guilt factor in American life. Now, I think it's an open question. It could work in one of the most liberal enclaves on planet Earth, in on the island of Manhattan. We're going to sing "We Shall Overcome." We're going to protest on so many of progressivism's little acres, college campuses around the country, about the depredations of institutional systemic racism going on. Again, I find these are acts of desperation.
Well, and it's interesting you point out that these protests tended to take place in liberal enclaves. So Nate Silver reports that 80% of the women's marchers were in Hillary states, and they were particularly concentrated in major cities. And one thing this reminds us of is how inefficiently distributed Hillary's support was in geographic terms. You know, it doesn't matter how many people you pack into Grand Central, you know, on their way to the Women's March. You're only getting 29 electoral votes out of New York. So people came out for these marches. And so I think that shows us that there is a deep resistance to Trump. The question is whether that resistance can be broad enough to turn this little mini movement into sustained effective resistance.
I think that's an open question. Yes. We'll see. I mean, much of it will depend upon the evaluation of Donald Trump's administration 2 years down the road. Will he have done things that his supporters wanted him to do? If he has failed to do them, will he be the one they blame or not? Will they blame some Republican senators who resisted him? And you'll find Tea Party challenges to them in their home states. I wouldn't be surprised if Donald Trump targeted them as well. He doesn't owe them.
Today we have the 44th March for Life. Mike Pence will address the March for Life in person, which is the first time a vice president has ever done that. And Kellyanne Conway will also address the marchers, which I believe is also pretty unprecedented. So that's interesting, the presence of the Trump administration at the March for Life.
I think it tells you why, 80-85% of the evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. You know, they said, oh, this guy, he's awful, he's divorced, his sexual history, everything about that, he's not a good Christian. Well, again, people were able to see that if Donald Trump gets in office, yeah, okay, he doesn't sound like the Jerry Falwell figure, the political figure there, but his people will be there at the march. If he says that he wants judges who respect the Constitution and who don't like Roe v. Wade, he means it. He'll come through on this. So I think that the March for Life and the Trump's administration there vindicates the social conservatives who were able to see Donald Trump's politics beyond the person that many social conservatives didn't like.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out why exactly is Trump the first president to have a VP and a high-ranking official go to the March for Life? Because apparently Bush didn't do that, neither Bush did that, Reagan didn't do it. Is that because the Bushes and Reagan were less pro-life than Trump? Probably not, but it seems like this is apparently one of those protocol-breaking moments, as in previously it just wasn't done that you send your people right to the March for Life, and Trump is just not very obedient to protocol.
I see Republican establishment figures have been running away from the cultural issues for 50 years. It's not cool. Hollywood's going to criticize you. When Dan Quayle said about Murphy Brown having a child out of wedlock, you know, single motherhood by choice, when he said this is not a good role model, boy, did she jump on him. Even on her show, she brought everyone out and said, Mr. Quayle, and started lecturing to him. And from what I remember of that episode, I didn't hear any Republican leaders coming out and defending Dan Quayle on this. They ran for the hills. Murphy Brown is popular. We don't want to get into this. So I think on the social issues, the Republican establishment figures, they have steadily softened. Even if they believe them, it's not politic to go into it. And when you have the libertarian conservatives who are liberals on social issues, many of whom are big donors, you know, the Koch brothers, they're liberal on the social issues. Well, you know, let's not lose those people as well. I think so many of us are so tired of being lectured to by people who live in Malibu, by people who have no political experience at all, and they live again in this, you know, other universe of wealth and fame. We're tired of being told how deplorable we are.
William Peter Blatty died on January 12th at the age of 89. He was a New Yorker and a Georgetown alum, a novelist and a Hollywood screenwriter, specializing in light comedies and obscene horror. He was a political conservative and a fabulously dogmatic Catholic. He's best known as the author of The Exorcist. He wrote both the novel of 1971 and the screenplay for William Friedkin's film adaptation of 2 years later. I happen to love, love, love The Exorcist, novel and film. I'm joined on this segment by William Peter Blatty. I'm channeling him through a mystical medium called audible.com. He'll read selections from his novel whenever I ask him to.
I cast you out, unclean spirit.
Good to have you, Bill. You probably know the plot of The Exorcist, but I'll review it quickly. In the D.C. suburb of Georgetown, in the early 1970s, a 12-year-old girl named Regan evinces disturbed behavior, acting out in profane and erratic ways. Her mother, a film actress named Chris McNeil, takes Regan to the best physicians she can find. The physicians regretfully refer Regan to the psychiatrists. The psychiatrists, very bashfully, send her to the priests. Chris seeks out the tortured Georgetown Jesuit Damien Karras, who, despite his doubts, obtains permission to perform an exorcism. Actually, he is to assist at the exorcism, which will be performed by the older, taller Jesuit Lancaster Marin, a dazzling intellectual modeled on Teilhard de Chardin and John Henry Newman. The two Jesuits succeed in the exorcism at the cost of their lives. The novel and film are full of unmentionables, as the demon disfigures Regan's body and her personality. Satan sells. The novel topped the New York Times bestseller list for 17 weeks. The film, which could have been a fiasco, became a sensation. Theatergoers were screaming, fainting in the aisles, crossing themselves, converting. It was the scariest movie of all time. I think it's not nearly as scary now as it was in 1973. The special effects no longer impress. But much else about the film does still impress. The acting is superb, the dialogue often ditto. The Exorcist may be scary or not, but it's a fine human drama, and a fine theological drama. Notwithstanding the presence of Jesuits, its theology is actually coherent. I see you, Martin Scorsese. Blatty's project in The Exorcist was a homiletic one. He wanted more people to believe vividly in God. He thought a clever way of advertising God would be to go about it backwards, as it were, because to get people to believe in God's opposite number was pretty simple. So at the end of the novel, Chris says that she still doesn't believe in God, but the devil...
Well, the devil's something else. I could buy that. In fact, maybe I do. You know why? Because the creep keeps doing commercials.
The devil keeps doing commercials. Foreign wars, domestic turmoil, demonic possession. It's important to understand that Blatty believed in the reality of demonic possession. He based The Exorcist on what he took to be the true events surrounding the 1949 exorcism of a boy known pseudonymously as Robbie Mannheim. Blatty had read about the exorcism of Robbie Mannheim in the Washington Post, and he took it to be proof that the devil existed, and therefore proof that God existed. Robbie Mannheim was visibly afflicted by an active, intelligent agent of evil, and if we can believe in that agent, the devil, then why not in God, an active, intelligent agent of good? If Robbie was delivered from evil, then some very powerful goodness must have delivered him.
At the end of the novel, a Jesuit friend of Karis's counsels Chris.
But if all of the evil in the world makes you think that there might be a devil, Chris, how do you account for all of the good? I never thought of that, she murmured. Yeah, good point.
The devil is real, and he is not sovereign. This is the simplest theological gloss on The Exorcist. But there's more to be said, having to do with why Blatty thought he needed to go about arguing for God backwards. He was very impressed by the devil's many commercials. In fact, he reused that figure of speech in a line in the screenplay for his 1980 film, The Ninth Configuration. Blatty simply felt that the world was not advertising God's goodness. Call this a spiritual crux and an aesthetic one. Blatty found human experience basically disgusting, and he was tempted to despair on that account. His spiritual struggles resembled those of Karis, I believe. So what's bothering Karis? Mundane things, he says.
The need to rend food with the teeth and then defecate. My mother's 9 first Fridays. Stinking socks. Thalidomide babies.
Blatty once said in an interview something like, anyone who can contemplate seriously the human gastrointestinal system and not begin to doubt the existence of a benevolent creator God, well, I just don't understand you. The evacuation of waste is one of the devil's commercials. This helps us understand the famous scene in which Regan, in the early stages of possession, interrupts her mother's party by urinating on the carpet. Broadly, it helps us understand why The Exorcist is so gross. The pea soup vomit, the blood, the head spinning and other physical contortions, the lacerations and deformations. There's a serious yuck factor. What's the point of this? The audience may ask. Good question. During a pause in the exorcism, Karis asks Marin a similar thing. What's the point of possession from the devil's point of view? What's in it for him? This is in a dialogue that was cut down severely for the screenplay and cut entirely from the original theatrical release, but it's very important.
We say the demon cannot touch the victim's will. Then what would be the purpose of possession? What's the point? Ah, who can know, answered Marin. And yet, I think the demon's target is not the possessed. It is us, the observers. I think the point is to make us despair, to reject our own humanity, Damien, to see ourselves as ultimately bestial, vile and putrescent, without dignity, ugly, unworthy.
This style of despair was a particular temptation for Blatty, as for Karis and Marin. Earlier in his life, Marin had had a hard time loving his neighbor.
Certain people, they repelled me. And so how could I love them, I thought. It tormented me, Damien. It led me to despair of myself, and from that, very soon, to despair of my God. My faith was shattered.
In the present of the story, Karis is having a similar problem. It's not easy to love neighbors who repel you. In an early scene, Karis encounters a drunken bum on a subway platform. He knows that this bum is his neighbor and that he must love him and see Christ in him, but it's really hard.
A gray stubble derelict, numb on the ground in a pool of his urine, was sitting up. The priest looked away. He would come. He would whine, the vomit-flaked hand pressing down on the shoulder, the fumbling in his pocket for the holy medal, the reeking of the breath of 1,000 confessions, with the wine and the garlic and the stale mortal sins belching out all together and smothering, smothering. He could not bear to search for Christ again in stench and hollow eyes. For the Christ of pus and bleeding excrement, the Christ who could not be. The faint rumbling of an incoming train, then sounds of stumbling. The bum was staggering, about to faint, and with a blind, sudden rush, the priest got to him, caught him, dragged him to the bench against the wall. The priest eased him down, stretched him out. He quickly pulled a dollar from out of his wallet and placed it in the pocket of the derelict's jacket. Then decided he might lose it. He plucked out the dollar, stuffed it into a urine-damp trouser pocket, then picked up his bag and boarded the train. The dollar had been meant for his cab.
Catch the bleeding excrement and the gallons of urine. This is an incredibly scatological work. As I said, The Exorcist is gross. There's the pea soup vomit and the head spinning, and there's the everyday grossness of the bum in the subway, soaked in his own vomit and urine. The bum is one of the devil's most frequently aired commercials. And yet, if he's viewed properly, charitably, he is also one of Christ's commercials. The Christ of pus and bleeding excrement is an icon of this crux, which is both spiritual and aesthetic, in a world that seems to advertise the devil. You need to find a way to see Christ in your disgusting neighbor. You need to develop that charitable optic. Karras does. Even in this scene, he rescues the bum and gives him a dollar, though he doesn't feel inspired. And he confronts the Christ of pus and bleeding excrement in a big way when he meets Regan. By the time he meets her, with her stench and hollow eyes, she's not easy to love. She seems bestial, vile, and putrescent, and he could easily despair of her. But finally he reads her as a commercial not for the devil, but for Christ, whom he imitates by sacrificing his life to save her. There are many other points of interest in The Exorcist, but I'll content myself with one more. I've always enjoyed the way The Exorcist toys with science and superstition. As Chris seeks an explanation of Regan's affliction from professionals of different disciplines, there's an amusing narrative of descent from material to immaterial to even more immaterial. Chris turns first to the physicians. Like most moderns, she would be comforted by a diagnosis of tissue pathology. She'd like it to be some chemical imbalance or brain lesion, correctable by pills or surgery. When that starts looking unlikely, she wonders about psychiatric maladies, but the physicians are very reluctant to admit that Regan's disorder might not be in their handbook.
Now I know the temptation is to leap to psychiatry, but any responsible psychiatrist would exhaust the somatic possibilities first. That's the safest procedure.
The physicians are not just being territorial. They believe in their explanatory framework more than in psychiatry. They don't go as far as Nabokov, for whom Freud was the Viennese witch doctor. But they have a suspicion of psychiatric hocus-pocus. Psychiatry is a branch of medicine that proposes to conjure immaterial realities. Finally, the physicians admit defeat.
I guess it's time we started looking for a psychiatrist.
The psychiatrist's first attempt, a traditional talking cure.
I am speaking to the person inside of Regan now. If you are there, you too are hypnotized and must answer all my questions.
And they only elicit a disastrous manifestation of the demon. Chris then commits Regan to a psychiatric institution, the Behringer Clinic, modeled on the mid-century Menninger Clinic. The Behringer shrinks are baffled. In the film, we see a montage of Regan getting worse and worse under their care. And then a marvelous scene. All the Behringer psychiatrists are around a conference table, advising Chris of her options, or her lack of options. The film does this better than the novel.
Of course, there is one outside chance for a cure. But I think of it as a shock treatment. As I said, it's a very outside chance.
Would you just name it, for God's sakes? What is it?
Do you have any religious beliefs?
No.
What about your daughter?
No. Why?
Have you ever heard of exorcism? Well, it's a stylized ritual in which the rabbi or the priest try to drive out the so-called invading spirit. It's been pretty much discarded these days, except by the Catholics, who keep it in the closet as a sort of an embarrassment. But it has worked, in fact, although not for the reasons they think. Of course, it's purely a force of suggestion. The victim's belief in possession is what helped cause it. So in that same way, the belief in the power of exorcism can make it disappear.
You're telling me that I should take my daughter to a witch doctor. Is that it?
Wonderful deadpan moment. The look on the psychiatrist's face as he sits back, absorbing that blow, priceless. Chris does seek out a priest or witch doctor, but there's this little hiccup. Father Karras is not just a priest, he's also a trained psychiatrist, two witch doctors in one. But he doesn't believe in demonic possession. When Chris asks how a person can get an exorcism, he doesn't take her seriously.
Oh, well, first you'd have to put him in a time machine and get him back to the 16th century. Well, it just doesn't happen anymore. Since we learned about mental illness and schizophrenia and split personality, all those things that they taught me at Harvard.
What the church used to call possession, now we understand is psychopathology. But eventually Chris convinces him, with a little assist from the demon, that Regan needs not a psychiatrist, but a priest. From physician to psychiatrist to priest, the descent is complete. But there's a nice irony observable with 45 years of hindsight. Medical men, too, have had their superstitions, which time has exposed. So about split personality.
It was the neurologist who answered. Mrs. McNeil, he said gently. There haven't been more than 100 authenticated cases of split personality in all of medical history. It's a very rare condition.
Actually, it's a non-existent condition. Multiple personalities are not a thing, as the psychiatric profession now understands. If you want to get treated for multiple personality disorder by anyone other than a quack, you'll need to get in a time machine and go back to the 1980s. What did William Peter Blatty do after The Exorcist? Nothing of consequence, at least not as a writer or a filmmaker. But he warmed the hearts of conservative Catholics everywhere when in 2013 he authored a canon law petition asking Donald Cardinal Wuerl to revoke the Catholic and Jesuit status of Georgetown University. Blatty's alma mater had failed in many and various ways to conform to the apostolic constitution Ex Corde Ecclesiae, and it had scandalized the faithful by credentialing pro-abortion student groups and inviting Kathleen Sebelius to speak at commencement. The Vatican has ruled that Blatty's complaint against Georgetown is well-founded, and perhaps something may still come of it. So next time you're on a Catholic campus and you encounter an administrator who cares more about the Land O'Lakes statement than about Ex Corde Ecclesiae, raise your voice and say with Bill Blatty,
I cast you out, unclean spirit, along with every power of the enemy, every specter from hell, every savage companion.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleague, Mark Bauerlein. Thanks to William Peter Blatty for his prose and vocal stylings. Thanks to whatever demon it was that infested my microphone with creepy static right when I was talking about the real-life possession of Robbie Manheim. I regard your interference as recorded evidence of the devil, and therefore of God, and I'm really grateful. And thank you, listeners.